I'm not necessarily populist. I find the notion a bit strange that normal people have a say in their governance, and we live in a so-called democracy, but it doesn't really function that way. It never really has. The people truly get the government that they want. And when has that ever happened? When has everyone actually been satisfied?
Joshua Firm is a presenter and psychology researcher who specializes in the study of decision-making. He is libertarian and an advocate for limited government, free trade, and social conservatism.
That human beings basically have an insatiable appetite for more material goods. It's why in economics they talk about human wants being infinite. If a government pays attention to this and tries to cater to it, then what it's going to do is drive the ruination of your civilization.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic on Tour. I am in an extremely smart hotel in Birmingham. You'd think it would be awful, and you're right, but this particular bit of Birmingham is quite pleasant. And I am at the Witan Conference, and I am with my friend, Mr. Josh Firm. Josh, hello.
Hello.
How are you enjoying what's been going on so far?
It's been great. It's been good fun. Lots of like-minded people, you know. A few drinks.
You were up till what time?
Three in the morning,
chaps. I was up to about 10 to 5. I don't know how it happened, but there's a sort of a balcony here, and it just kind of, yeah, like-minded people. Now, people will know you from the Lotus Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I first met you. But what is it you've moved into now?
So I've got my own YouTube channel where I do mainly informative videos. It's a lot of psychology heavy things, which is my specialization. But also other things, like I was talking about how the environment of cities are bad for you. I was talking about parasitology. I think that's how you say it. I can't remember. But basically about a parasite that cats carry that influences human behavior. Talked about people who are missing half of the hemisphere of their brain. Now we've lived perfectly normal lives and things like that. So there's a lot of psychology, but it's not going to be exclusive to that. I did a video about the value of wild camping, for example, which is a bit different. But the idea is this is a nice sort of outlet, because I've been in the trenches of, you know, the daily news and sort of rank punditry and, you know, the news cycle for almost 5 years. And I think that the key is to have something else going on. You need to have a balance there. And I felt like I needed to address that, because I think as a human being, you can't just talk about one thing and that be it in your everyday life. You know, obviously you can be known for a specialization, but to be a well-rounded human being, you've got to have multiple different...
Presumably you can apply that specialization to multiple interesting things, though.
That's exactly it. And I think because I specialized in psychology, there's always a way in which, you know, it can apply to something. It's very rare to find an exception to that, really.
So did you do a psychology degree originally?
Yes, so I did an undergraduate degree, and then I did a master's degree in psychological research methodology. So that's a lot about how to actually run scientific experiments and all of the statistics and the data side of it, which has come very handy in politics, actually.
And this is in Plymouth?
I did the master's in Bath, but I stayed in Plymouth where I grew up originally, mainly just because I had a job.
And what was that?
I was working as a lifeguard. I wasn't very good at it, actually.
You mean people drowned on your watch? Or?
They didn't. Nobody drowned. But it was my first job. And the person who inducted me actually got later fired for falling asleep on the job. And so I felt like I was sort of set up to fail.
That sketch, you know, where that guy's sole job is to watch the pool at night and then someone dies. It sounds a bit like that, yes.
So I dodged a bullet with that, really, but... Mm. That was the only reason I stayed there, is just because it was the only way I could financially do it.
So let's go back then, before we look at that, because you have your following and whatever, people like to know about these chaps, the power of friendships and women that are obsessed with you and all that kind of stuff. So if we go back to when you were a child and the teachers used to make fun of your name because it sounds a bit rude. Like, let's go back. Go back.
This is a lot further than I'm used to in interviews.
Oh, is it? Oh, is that all right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
We'll talk about how firm you were when you were a kid and so forth. So you brought up in Plymouth.
Yeah, just on the very edge of it. You know, half my family comes from Devon, half my family is Scottish. But I grew up in the southwest and south Devon, and that's where I call home. And it's a very different part of the world to the rest of England, I feel. It's its own unique thing in a way.
How's that?
It's not only in terms of just physically, the geography makes it feel different, but the people are different as well, I feel, in that when you're in the Southwest, people are, it's a lot more warmth than perhaps closer to London. People will stop and chat. You know, where I grew up, there's still to this day an honesty box of fruit and veg out at the end of people's driveways. People put books out that people borrow from one another. There's this sense of unbroken community because there's not really been that much in the way of immigration down there. And so a lot of the local communities are intact. A lot of the people have roots there that span hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I think that it gives this warm feeling as well as it being the place that I'm most familiar with. And it's very laid back as well.
So as a psychologist, as a chap who knows about these things, why do you think that, do you think it is immigration that causes this to break down?
Well, I think that you don't necessarily need immigration for this to break down, but it helps. I think that the breakdown is ultimately that people think that this sort of civic sense, this kindness to thy neighbor is not reciprocated and therefore they don't engage in it. Because there are many people who I've spoke to who've grown up in cities, and this is a completely alien concept, but they're fascinated by it. They love it. They want to experience it, but they're not going to do it because they live in a place where it's not going to be reciprocated. And if you do kind things for other people and it's not reciprocated, well, that's just a great way to have people take advantage of you.
Yeah.
And so it makes good sense that if you're skeptical about people doing the same in return, you're not going to do it.
And you'll be more skeptical if they're very different from you.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I was brought up in Wimbledon, and we didn't have things like you're saying. People didn't, because they'd be stolen. And that's actually independent immigration, right? I mean, that's just if it was in a white area.
That's exactly the point I was trying to make, really, because this sort of thing didn't necessarily exist in all of England throughout all the time. It's a very parochial thing in the nice, friendly corners of England, I think, and Wales and Scotland, I imagine.
Corners. I can hear the accent there, just about.
Really?
Yeah. It's funny when people have an overlay of received pronunciation, but there's little things that twang through.
I've been told this, that people can actually pick up on from Devon every now and then. I think that the biggest giveaway is, up until I was about, I don't know, 21, 22, I thought it was perfectly reasonable to say, oh, where's that to? As in, where is that?
And yeah.
Everyone I knew used that phrase, and I thought it was widespread. And it sort of blew my mind when someone at university was like, what? What did you just say to me?
Like, the university in Plymouth?
Well, yeah.
Wouldn't they know such things there?
Well, people go from other places.
Oh, of course. Yes, indeed, there is that. I forgot about that. Yeah, and also, of course, last night when we had dinner, Josh only ate clotted cream.
That's true.
So there's also
by the barrel.
Yeah, he loves it. So you went, did you go? What kind of school did you go to? Did you go to just the local school? Huh?
Yeah, well, I could have gone to the grammar school, and it was a decent one, but I chose not to. One, because I lived 2 minutes down the road from a comprehensive that was pretty good, and all my friends were going to it.
Right.
So it was a pretty easy choice in my mind, and thankfully my parents were of the right mind of, you know, you go to the school that you're most happy at, and if we have to supplement your education, we will. And they've always been very supportive of it.
What do they do?
They're both retired, but my dad worked in the dockyard in Plymouth. That's how he came down from Scotland.
Oh, right.
Transferred from Rosyth, but he worked in luxury yachts and military defence, basically.
Oh,
okay. My mother was a bank manager.
Exciting stuff. Good. And so why did you choose to read psychology? What was it that was attractive about that?
So I'm actually going to quote something that I wrote in my personal statement when I applied, that I actually first noticed that I was most interested in psychology because I was also in my A-levels, I was studying politics and history as well as psychology. And originally I was going to do joint honours politics and history, which, you know, makes sense. They pair together very nicely. And then I realised that when I was in my history class or my politics class, I was thinking more about the psychological motivations of people than the actual content I was supposed to.
Mm.
And I was just like, actually, this seems to be interesting me more, even though psychology, I sort of pinned it on as well. I don't think I'm going to go anywhere with it. I just find it interesting. And one of the things that I also clocked quite young, probably a lot younger than many people, is that if you want to be able to order the world and, you know, live in a world that is desirable and civilized, well, you've got to have a good understanding of human nature, because you've got to cater the world to human nature, because, you know,
It would be, if you have a system that is ill-fitting, that doesn't account for human nature, then it's going to cause untold suffering. And so I felt like the more pertinent problem for civilization is understanding ourselves before we started trying to change the world, which, you know, Jordan Peterson has popularized that sort of turn of phrase now, hasn't he?
And people that try and change the world often don't understand themselves.
Exactly.
Otherwise, that idea as well. They're dealing with their problems
and
with themselves.
In fact, I would go so far to say that the people who are most compelled to change the world often are grappling with something themselves.
Because they're not happy about the situation.
Exactly.
And they're happy about something. They don't know what, but they're happy about something. Yeah, I did A-level history. And I was like, why didn't we look at the psychology of Metternich, for example, or the psychology of Bismarck?
We covered the Russian Revolution. And so when we were learning about the Russian revolutionaries, they're a weird bunch of characters, aren't they? And I was thinking, like, this Lenin fellow, why was he so obsessed? Why did he do nothing but work the entire time? That's a bit strange. Why was he like that? That sort of thing of trying to understand the character of the people. I think that does make you a better historian, but it also showed to me that, you know, psychology is where...
Well, it crosses the boundaries. I mean, that's what E.O. Wilson said in Consilience, that new knowledge comes from crossing the boundaries of separate disciplines.
That's another one of those things that I realised, is that lots of people specialise in their own discipline and they have this nice, neat and tidy notion of, this is what I do, this is the boundaries, anything beyond that is not my, you know, place to have an opinion on. I was much more excited by the idea of taking a principle from, say, geology and applying it to, I don't know, human nature or something, like to these disparate theories and things like that. I find that interesting, even if they're just analogies that sort of tease at something but don't get it quite right. I find it interesting to play with these ideas and try and get a deeper understanding just by taking the knowledge from somewhere else and applying it where it wasn't originally intended, just to see what happens, because I find it interesting more than anything, isn't it? I suppose there's a goal of, you know, finding the truth about the world in an overarching sense, but it's mainly because it's fun. And you've got to enjoy these sorts of things to get good at them in the first place.
One of the things we were talking about earlier, or I brought it up, was the comparison between this that we're at and sort of fundamentalist Christian groups. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, the sense of being persecuted, the sense of being an outsider, the sense of having the truth but other people don't understand it or whatever. And one of the things that you get in these fundamentalist Christian groups is what they call their testimony, which is, I don't know how much you're familiar with these kinds of groups.
Not very.
No.
Pretty atheistic upbringing.
Are you one of these kind of Gen Z type people that were not even christened?
I was christened.
God for that. Well, I suppose you are quite middle class. okay, good. Not a heathen. But they have their testimony. And this is that they have to get up and say, I gave my life to Jesus at this point. And one of the things that's interesting about being here is that everyone seems to have a testimony, which is, I became red-pilled at this point. Mm-hmm. Do you have a point like that?
I think so, but it's not very neat. It's not like there was some switch. It was just the beginning of, it's like, you know, a snowball that turns into an avalanche sort of thing. But I've also had aspects of myself, just my personality and disposition, that lean more this way and quite conscientious, quite orderly. I care a lot about morality and fair play and these sorts of things. These were ingrained into me long before I had any notion of the existence of politics, you know, by just my upbringing and genes, pretty much. But I think the thing that was the point where I was sort of repulsed by the left, you know, I was basically a bit of a liberal. I was more concerned about reforming systems in the same way that I was like, we've got to sort out human nature. I was like, we have to sort out the political system before we can start addressing things. Otherwise, we won't have the desired outcomes. And so I sort of considered myself left-leaning-ish, but not massively.
When you were a student, or
yes, when I was a student, when I was young and not paying tax, as is often the case. But I went to a hustings event. If you're not familiar, it's basically an event where politicians come, you know, turn up that are running for an election, and it was a student one. So they came to the university voluntarily to just educate the students, and I noticed how rude some of the students were to some of the panelists, particularly the right-wing ones. And I was like, well, they've taken time out of their day to come here. They're not getting paid. It's not going to win them the election. A bunch of students that probably, you know, have already made up their minds already. So they've taken time out of their day to help, you know, they've said explicitly to help educate us and talk about politics and involve us as we were very young. And they were being rude to them. And it was the discourtesy of someone's taking time out of their day to help you and you're being rude in return because you disagree with something that made me think, I don't want to be associated with you. And then that led me down the road of, well, why don't I figure out what the right believe? Because I don't really like the left, that they're nasty people, they're discourteous and rude, and it's probably the most middle-class way to be radicalized possible. But then I ended up watching things like Carl, obviously. And one of the ones that I really enjoyed was Gavin McInnes, actually. And the reason was because it wasn't necessarily explicitly.
He reminds me of the cameraman that's filming us at the moment. honestly, he does.
But the reason I enjoyed it and I could watch it, even though I disagreed with some of what he said at the time, was because it was funny and he was pushing boundaries. And it was more like comedy to me. And so in some ways, I was radicalized by impoliteness and comedy.
Right.
Which is a very weird thing to sort of be pushed in this direction, but to sort of fast forward a bit.
Because that's the thing with the left, though, that I find their sense of humour limited.
It's just crassness, really, isn't it? It's just being rude.
It's being rude, and it used to be that when it was very much more a conservative society, up until, let's say, 97, you could, to some extent, you could reasonably say it's people that are born in the 30s or whatever, it's quite a conservative generation, that, or 40s even, that are in power. And then it shifted. But they didn't shift. They didn't then start, once it became a left-wing society, they didn't start attacking the right. No, they were what, as I think Nick Dixon calls them, regime comedians. Mm-hmm. Like their purpose was to attack a right-wing power group that no longer really has power at all.
I always had that impression, actually, that they're basically attacking a way of life that didn't really exist anymore. And it just wasn't, it wasn't edgy, it wasn't funny, it was just a bit pathetic.
You can see it in Have I Got News For You.
Yeah.
Have I Got News For You was funny in the 90s when there was still a conservative society and they were kind of reacting against it. It was quite funny. But now it's a lot of it is the kind of where they don't laugh, they clap because they agree with your political statement.
Yeah, if someone starts clapping and you're a stand-up comedian, that's a sign you've failed. Unless it's at the end, in which case you've done well. But they should be laughing. They shouldn't be applauding. That's entirely wrong. It's like people go up and have some sort of diatribe about their political views rather than making people laugh. And that's, in many ways, antithetical to what comedy is about, because I go there to escape this sort of thing, not to have it shoved down my throat.
No, indeed. So you did psychology and you did a master's, I think you said, didn't you?
That's right, yeah.
Also in the Southwest. He doesn't like leaving the Southwest.
I don't, that's true.
Doesn't like it.
I hate it.
It's bad. And it is. Like, this is not as nice as the Southwest. I think we can, with the exception possibly of Bristol, which is awful.
Oh, yeah, we don't talk about Bristol.
Forget Bristol. Remove Bristol. But what did you do then? So by this time, I guess you're about 23, 22.
Touch older. I took a year in between doing my master's just to save up the money to pay for it. So I did, you know, odds and ends, mostly bar work that I picked up when I quit being a lifeguard because I hated it. And I hated bartending as well. But basically I did that, saved up enough money to do the master's. And then as I was doing my master's degree, it was 2020, and I was watching all the stuff going on in America with Black Lives Matter, and they were burning things down with impunity. And to my mind, this was like, wow, this is the beginning of the end, right? This is the anti-civilizational riots, basically. This is antithetical to anything good and decent and worth saving about the world, that this is happening. And it really radicalized me because it's like, well, I see the parallels here now.
With what?
With the racial groups causing problems.
Right.
And it's sort of that phrase that... if America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. I knew that it was inevitably going to come here because there's such an interwoven relationship with the American culture in Britain. And that really put a fire in my belly to get involved because it's like, well, why is no one pushing back against this? Why is nothing happening? And so the day after I finished my master's dissertation and submitted it, I was watching one of Carl's streams talking about this very thing. And he mentioned in passing, oh yeah, I'm looking to hire a writer. I thought, well, this is perfect. I've just finished my work. I've had a few gin and tonics. I can't remember. And so I'm gonna apply for this.
It's always best to write your application when you've had a couple of gin and tonics, I think.
And the funny thing is as well, that because I couldn't be bothered to do my CV because I just spent ages doing a dissertation, I was like, well, if he's looking for a writer, I'm going to write it out in prose and you know, show and not tell. So I wrote out my background and my qualifications in sentences, put in a CV and an email. And they asked me for an interview, and I thought, okay, well, this is a day out. It was the lockdowns at the time. So it's like, well, this is this is essential travel. Like, it's an excuse to get out of the house. I can go all the way up from Plymouth to
lovely Swindon.
To Swindon, which I realized later on was horrible. And the first time I went there, I basically went to the Costa next to the train station and then went back on the train again. So I didn't explore it, didn't know what I was in for. But because I just thought, well, I'm a psychologist, you know, he's not going to really want me. I just sort of saw it as an opportunity for a day out. And so I didn't take it seriously. It's like, well, I get to meet Carl and say hello and have a little chat and have a bit of fun. And that's what I saw it as. And because I was very relaxed, I think I came across pretty well in the interview. I wasn't nervous at all because I didn't see there as any stakes. And then I remember after the fact, Callan, you know, traveling the world, Callan, former Lotus Eater, said to me that part of the reason that they liked me is that I smiled a lot and had fun and didn't take it too seriously.
Yeah.
And it sort of worked in my favour that I was sort of indifferent to the outcome.
Yeah, that was my impression. I mean, I've been on the Lotus Eaters, I can't remember, is it two times, three times, I can't remember what it is. And it is a fun office.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. That's so important when people are doing an office job. Okay, like most people doing an office job, it's a boring job involving putting data into a machine about other data that then turns into more data, or they don't really understand what they do. And so for those people in particular, it has to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only done one office job ever when I was 18. A friend of mine from the local Conservative Association was one of the directors of the Royal Bank of Scotland. And he created this job for me. And there really wasn't anything to do. And I was told on my first day by the kind of David Brent type, the guy that had his own little sub office, you know,
mm-hmm.
I've been told by the director of the bank to create this job for you. I have to tell you, there's nothing for you to do. But don't like tell the other workers that. And then you understand that this guy's God to this organization. I have to do what he says. And I was like, okay. So I didn't tell them. But then, they did little things like they played tricks on each other and had like office traditions. Like if you go on holiday, you have to buy one cake or.
I think that's pretty commonplace. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Something to break the monotony. So it's so important, I think, that it's a fun atmosphere. I remember there was this girl, this woman that was my kind of, sort of, the person I answered to, essentially. She's called Dawn, Scottish. One of those Nicola Sturgeon-type, humourless, dour Scots.
They do get like that.
If there was a sort of a bell curve of dourness, then the shift is slightly higher in Scots, and thus you get dour Scots that are more dour than anything you can imagine in England.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like that, miserable cow. She went on holiday a couple of weeks during the time that I was working there. And it was just such a happier place because Dawn wasn't there. Everyone felt it and talked about it.
It's funny, isn't there, that there are people that can just ruin an atmosphere just by their mere presence. I've encountered it in my life before, and it's. I almost feel a little bit bad for them, except I realise that it's because they're a bad person.
They
are morally accountable.
It's probably why they used to hang witches. It is. I mean, these were like evil women that would used to go around cursing people in a context where people believed in the power of the curse, nocebo effect. You know about the nocebo effect,
being
a psychologist,
yeah.
And it was real. It was very real.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case in Pendle of this in about 1610 of this little girl who was part of like a cunning folk family, and she cursed this guy because he wouldn't buy pins off her.
It's always
and he had a stroke. From what we can work out now, he fell down and had a stroke. But in the end, she was hanged. So.
Perfect.
As well, her whole family. Yeah. So you started working with the Lotus Eaters. So a lot of my viewers are probably familiar with the Lotus Eaters. They've seen me on there. They've watched it. Whatever. So what's that? What was the atmosphere? It was a fun atmosphere in the office. What did you?
Oh yeah, it was great. It felt like a bunch of lads just having a laugh. Really, it didn't necessarily feel like, especially when we're starting out. Like I didn't even take my stuff out of my colourful boxes because when we started, Carl was like, listen. You know, we don't have much resources to make this work, so be prepared if it doesn't. And he's pretty open about that.
This was right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, yeah. And so it meant that we didn't necessarily take it as seriously as we could have and had a lot of fun, which I think is good. And I think it's also why people enjoy Lotuses over perhaps other coverage, is that we did have fun. We did try and lighten the mood and make jokes, and we all like our comedy.
I wonder what the office atmosphere is like in Navarra Media.
I bet that's dour.
Oh, I bet it is.
That Scottish lady could blend in nicely.
She'd love it. She'd love it there. If you're watching Dawn from Barking, originally from Glasgow, and you're still alive, try maybe get yourself a job working for Navarra Media. But yes, so and you were there for how long? Quite about 5 years.
Yeah, so I think I my first day was the 20th of November 2020. And I know that because it's 2 days after my birthday. I don't have that specific a memory. And I think I finished around May time of this year. So it's about 4.5 years, roughly-ish.
So why did you feel you wanted to move on and leave?
Well, it's not that I've moved on fully. And I said this when I left, is that I'm still going to come back and do the, you know, podcast here and there. It's more that all I was doing was talking about the daily news. And I felt like over the course of 5 years, I've sort of said everything I wanted to say. My opinions hadn't changed that much. I felt like there wasn't too much to develop anymore. And I was worried that I was going to get to a point where I would just be repeating stuff back to people that have already heard it, which just makes them more angry. And by making them more angry, it makes them feel like they have less agency to improve their situation. So basically, make
does it do that, or does it galvanize them to act?
Well, it can be a mixture of both, can't it?
Because I hear that if you go for a bad restaurant, go to an awful restaurant, you tell a lot more people than if you go to a good restaurant.
That's true. But I basically felt like I'd done my bit, and I was worried, not necessarily justifiably, about the impact it would have on the audience if I were just angrily repeating myself. And I find it a lot more manageable now to do it maybe once a week. And I can do other things, like talk about my other interests, because I think it's very important to have multiple different disparate interests. I sort of admire the 19th century polymaths in a way. I see it as a model to aspire to. And I'm not saying that I've achieved that, by the way. I'm not that arrogant, but I think it's something that you should try and work towards. And whether you achieve that or not is, you know,
Wouldn't it be good to interview? I mean, I'm enjoying interviewing you. It's great. But wouldn't it be good to interview Francis Galton?
Oh, I'd love it, yeah.
Imagine
personal heroes.
If we had Francis Galton sitting here, right, filming him, doing it, clipping it together, wouldn't it be amazing?
Oh, it would.
Things he did, photography, innovations, mathematics.
Invented statistics, didn't he?
Invented.
Physiognomy, the criminal faces.
Criminal faces, yeah.
Who's going to say the controversial one?
You can say it.
Eugenics.
Indeed, eugenics. And he 1865, chaps. 1865, he wrote that book.
To be fair, he was... I've read his writing, and he's not... When you hear eugenics, you think of, you know, he wants to round everyone up and kill them, but he wasn't saying that.
No.
It was a lot more moderate than that.
It was basically just neo... It was neo-Plato. I mean, it was basically what Plato said.
Yeah.
People forget that. Plato, eugenics. In fact, pretty much all of the great people of Western civilization seem to be eugenicists, as far as I can work out. But I mean, like, people celebrate the suffragettes. These people were major eugenicists. Gandhi, mm-hmm. eugenicist. I mean, they just go, all the statues in Parliament Square, every single one. Smuts, mm-hmm. Churchill, Lloyd George.
Parenthood is another example in the United States.
The whole of social work was founded by eugenicist women in order to dissuade poor people from having too many babies. That was who founded social work. Something Richardson, her name was. Susan Richardson or something?
That sounds about right.
Right. Eugenics. Everybody, eugenics. And now we see it. We're here in Birmingham, chaps, and we've all driven in here. And you drive through these places like King's Norton and whatever. You're just like, oh, my good God. and we were talking about this earlier. Let's go on to that, actually. So we were... This idea that we need, you were saying, that we need more and more and want more and more because relative to other people. Mm-hmm. But of course, the talent is less and less to actually produce it. And so all the government can do is just start putting up taxes and taking more people's money. What do you think about that? So let's expand on that, what you're saying. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, so the basic premise is that human beings don't assess their own well-being objectively. They do it referentially based on other people. But that means that human beings basically have an insatiable appetite for more material goods. It's why, you know, in economics, you know, they talk about human wants being infinite. And that's true. That, you know, obviously you don't want infinite amounts of things to the point of it being an inconvenience. But at the same time, you just shift what you desire, right? There's a reason that billionaires wake up and want to make more money, is that they assess themselves referentially to other billionaires. And so, you know, they want the bigger yacht they want. And so it's sort of a way in which people will never be happy. But if a government pays attention to this and tries to cater to it because it wins them, you know, goodwill with the electorate and that it allows them to win elections, then what it's going to do is drive the ruination of your civilization, because you're pursuing sort of needless things that you don't actually need to live a good life. Although I'm not necessarily a religious man, I do like the sort of philosophies that emphasize, and the religion aspects of the religions that do this, that emphasize the fact that happiness is up here in your head. It's nothing about the material world. Obviously, you know, if you're being tortured, that's important. That will probably make you pretty miserable if you're hungry. But once your base needs are met and you're not in physical pain, then you have the capacity to be perfectly happy and content. And all these material things that people chase are a waste of time. Sometimes they help, you know. I own a guitar. I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. But it's got to be a means to an end and not an end in and of itself. But I think that from the government's perspective, all it's doing is destabilizing society.
I have a PlayStation, or my son does. I play GTA 5. And I like it because it's like going back in time to 2012 when things were less weird. There's no trans flags in GTA 5. There's no transsexuals at all in GTA 5.
Certainly in the single player, yeah.
I haven't. What you mean, the online thing?
Yeah.
I've not partaken. But I'm told that the one that's coming out next year is going to be much higher up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's going to have women in it and gays and that.
Well, it's meant to represent Florida, isn't it? And so I suppose they'd be doing it an injustice if they didn't show the degeneracy. This is me sort of being a contrarian, but I agree with the general point you make.
They've got to show the degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
But as we get older and we all become Trevor and see ourselves as Trevor, become rather jaded,
mm-hmm.
or Michael. Or Trevor or Michael, as you get older. Michael's about 42, I think. Mm-hmm. He's a bit younger than me. Trevor's a bit older, I think he's 52. You know, you start to think differently. And you think things are falling apart. And they are. And you're doing a speech today, tomorrow, on the falling apart and what you think could be done about it. So could you give me a bit of a sneak preview?
Of course. So the sort of title I've given it is, you know, how to get lasting victory. And the ideas I'm going to be discussing are sort of from a political realist, sort of Machiavellian slant. I'm not going to necessarily moralize. I'm just going to say this is the optimal strategy to gain power and sustain it for as long as possible. And the general principle is that you've got to, when out of power, you've got to act as a government in waiting and attract competent and desirable people to then attract elite human capital, basically, because you need that not only for financial backing, but also you need the connections, you need them to open doors for you. There's all sorts of things that you need, but you need these elites to assemble to facilitate the cycle from the current elite to a new one. That's very important. And I'm going to go into detail about...
When has that happened before in British history? When have we changed elites?
Well, when I say elites, I mean, I'm going to be very specific in that. I mean, the people that are holding the levers of power, you know, you can be an elite and not necessarily have power in a political sense. It could be economic. You know, I don't think Chris Dawson, who's a, you know, local of mine, the owner of The Range, he's a billionaire, doesn't get involved in politics whatsoever. Wouldn't be fair to categorize him. He's certainly an elite. He's a billionaire. But you wouldn't put him in the same category as someone who holds political power, who might be far less wealthy, but far more.
So you're talking about people that are influential. So that's that's politicians, and also the people whose thoughts and ideas influence those politicians, those kinds of people. So as I say, I'd be interested to have an example, because I've been reading a lot about this for later, Pareto, elite theory and so on. When have we asked, do you think, changed elites?
Well, you can look at the transitions between, say, the Stuarts and the Hanovers and the like, the transfer of quite literally different. You know, you've got the Normans, you've got the Saxons, you've got all of these different groups. And obviously it's there's an ethnic aspect or a national aspect to it. But I don't think that that's necessary. It's just something that binds the group together. But I think that in the modern day, there's less clear boundaries, particularly with the governing elite that believe in multiculturalism.
Well, so would 1997 be an example of a kind of a change of elites?
No, because I think that Tony Blair was basically a continuity of Margaret Thatcher. You know, Margaret Thatcher herself said that her greatest achievement was Tony Blair.
Was Margaret Thatcher from Jim Callaghan a changing of elites? Was that a real change?
I don't know enough about Callaghan to really answer it.
I'd love to get
an actual specific example.
Well, I mean, obviously, because all I can think of it in terms of examples that come to me, then if you're going to reject those, is just revolutions.
Yeah, well, I think a very clear example that people might be a bit more familiar with, is not one that I'd necessarily suggest emulating, by the way, before people get too carried away, is that of Adolf Hitler, right? That was a clear change of elite in that the people who were ruling Nazi Germany were different people than before.
If you think about it, there were quite a lot of people. That's interesting. This idea, you know, in Pareto, if you're familiar with him.
Of course.
Well, no, of course. But, I mean, I only came across him recently, frankly. But the foxes and the lions.
Yes, I've heard that.
And so the foxes are the Machiavellian, devious, dishonest kind of people. Mm-hmm. Basically, they
It stems from Machiavelli himself.
Yes, exactly.
The prince, yeah.
Exactly. And they are the what? They're power hungry. They're individually oriented, whatever. And then there's the lions that, to some extent, are group oriented and will push back against the elites, so the more populist type of people. Sort of thing. I don't know how good this division is, chaps, but that's his division. And one of the things that he notes is that when you get a shift, well, not him, but an analysis of him I've recently read, that he notes is that when you get a shift like that, you could imagine that, yeah, there are the Nazi hardcore. There are the true believers. There are these people that are very high in group-oriented moral foundations, to put it in Jonathan Haidt's terms, and low in individually-oriented ones. They don't care about equality. They don't care about harm avoidance. But then there are also going to be the foxes that, I don't know, like, what was the guy called that was the finance minister of Nazi Germany? Or Schacht, was that his name?
I'm not sure.
Heilmar Schacht. And there were many others that just sort of saw an opportunity in the Nazis and realized what was going on, or even Albert Speer, and just shifted over. So you get even with a group like this, the people advocating these kinds of ideas that we're talking about at this conference, 20 years ago, those kinds of people, right? They were like weirdos. They were, for them, a Britain that was 10% or 5% foreign was unacceptable. Forget about 20% or 25%. I mean, these were odd people, often quite high in psychopathy, I think, which is why there's a lot of splitting and whatever. And now it's much more normal people, much more sensible people that are brought in as the thing shifts.
But that's how all social movements start, really. It's very extreme people lead more normal people to a different direction, no matter what it is.
You know, so when you say there's a shift in elites in Nazi Germany, there are the people that were there at the very beginning, you know, in the beer hall putsch and all this sort of thing, right? The nutcases, basically. Although even then they managed to get a few elite people involved, like that Field Marshal, whatever his name was. General, oh, I can't remember his name was. Everyone will know now, look it up. But then you're going to get much more normal people that are brought in the beginning. Goering, who was a national hero, right? War hero from World War One. But then eventually you just get people that are basically just conservatives.
Well, the conservatives basically went along with it. And that's the point I sort of wanted to get onto, is that They were clearly a very different group of people than the people who had been ruling previously. And the reason I picked it isn't because I, you know, have any sympathies towards National Socialism. It's more just, it's an example that people are familiar with, that everyone learnt at school. Mm-hmm. And so it's the easiest to bring to mind. And it was to the point whereby the pre-existing elite also, to some degree, went along with the supplantation of them, in that some of them actually sort of joined back in again, just at a lower social position.
Oh, yes, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're expecting would happen with us?
Well, it's obviously different circumstances. I like to view each instance as its own sort of case, if you will. I try and go by a case-by-case basis. But I do see certain principles that seem to be intrinsic parts of human nature, that there is a dedicated group that leads, it attracts people who are a bit more clued in, elites that pay attention to these sorts of things, these goings on, because they're interested in maintaining their status. They want to find new and interesting ideas to impress people at dinner parties and what have you. And then they draw them in, and then eventually it becomes enough of part of the zeitgeist that normal people are brought in. And I think that that's the way in which you can enact political change in a more realistic way. Like this, I'm not necessarily a populist. I find the notion a bit strange that normal people have a say in their governance. And I know we live in a so-called democracy, but it doesn't really function that way. And it never really has, that people truly get the government that they want. And when has that ever happened? When has everyone actually been satisfied?
Some engineers and doctors have probably done something. I suppose that there has to be, the idea is that it's some kind of outlet, some kind of means of gauging the view of the people and allowing them to feel that they matter, even though they don't. They're there to be ruled, obviously.
I mean, I'm not necessarily against democracy. I still, you know, I sort of agree with the Churchill view that it's the least bad system. But I also see that it unduly releases pressure being built up and gives people the illusion that they are actually contributing towards something when actually it's basically worthless. You know, going out and voting, does that really change anything? I know it all adds up, you know, but at the same time, I think, particularly in the current system where you can go from the Greens to reform, and it's just like, which flavour of neoliberalism do you want?
Well, I suppose one example, there's been two. One of the things that's been interesting about the last decade is there's been two, perhaps you could even say three, but certainly two, genuine shocks to the elite. And by the elite, I don't mean the aspirant elite, I don't mean the rival elite, I mean the liberal type elite, mm-hmm. the foxes. And that is the election, that is the referendum in the UK on Brexit and Trump, and both in the same year. And you see the reaction of just utter disbelief on the partly of the elite themselves, Nicola Sturgeon, whatever, being pissed off and grumpy, but partly the people whose niche in society is to get somewhere by kind of upholding the elite, like the screaming women in the street with blue hair kind of people, the Karens, the office managers,
the Guardian journalists,
the human resource managers, these kinds of scum, and it was their emotional reaction that because they're unstable people anyway, and hang on a minute, no, the world that I know and am part of and have a niche in that makes me feel important and worth something and allows me to not have to think about my demons, frankly, is now being changed in a way that will mean that my niche might go away. Heart speeds up, pump, 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 pump.
There's actually something really interesting about Brexit. I don't hear anyone really talking about that. David Cameron, you know, didn't support leaving the European Union, yet he put forward the idea of having a referendum. This is to basically placate his rebellious backbenchers, wasn't it? It was to keep control of his party, because at the time there were lots of backbenchers that were causing problems for him. And he basically thought, well, if I give them this, they're going to lose and they can shut up. In the same way that he did with the Lib Dems and an alternative voting system, he gave them, he insisted on putting on the ballot a voting system that the Lib Dems didn't want and were sort of lukewarm about campaigning about it, so that the referendum would come back with a result that was a resounding no. and then it could be put to bed. And he tried it again with Brexit, and it didn't work.
He tried it with Scottish independence.
Same there, yeah.
And it worked.
It did work that time. But the point here isn't necessarily the outcome. The point is how he viewed basically what is direct democracy is, we'll only give it to you if I can be certain that the result benefits me. And I think that's interesting. It says a lot about the psychology of the ruling elite, doesn't it? That they'll only put something to us if they know the outcome's relatively certain, is where they miscalculated.
How do you think, as a psychologist and so on, why do you think they managed to miscalculate? How did they do it? Why did you think that these people would be intelligent enough to know the mood, the way of the land, to know what was going on, and to know that it was probably not a good idea to call that referendum?
I think the world is so complicated that any one person can't really comprehend all of the factors that go into the cause and effect of events.
Are you ready for the future of the West? Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.